Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hello everyone and welcome back to the Indie Football Podcast. I'm your host Vidushan Antharaja and I'm joined today by our Northern Football Correspondent Mark Critchley and Assistant Sports Editor Jack Rathbone. Just the three of us this week, but no less level of, I suppose, surprise really after the shock of the weekend came at the Etihad with Manchester City suffering a 5-2 home defeat to Leicester City, the heaviest of Pep Guardiola's career in terms of goals conceded. I suppose there's been something of an instant reaction to this loss with the $62 million acquisition of Ruben Dias from Benfica. But Critch, we'll start with you. And did you see this coming?
It's a funny one. I think in terms of you would never expect Leicester City to win 5-2 at the Etihad, you know, and it's a scoreline that leaps out at you. But at the same time, in another way, it all felt just so predictable and familiar to what we've seen from Manchester City before. And in that sense, you know, there were the familiar problems with the press breaking down. For example, if you watch the first goal back, the move building up to the first penalty where Leicester just kind of totally play through City and Fernandinho, 35 years old now, gets caught upfield and suddenly they're in. We saw that time and again last season with different players other than Fernandinho. It doesn't seem to matter about personnel. They have these problems, and Guardiola was speaking afterwards about how he feels that City now have, they're a bit afraid of playing teams who are willing to sit very deep and defend tight and then break on the counter-attack like Leicester did in a bit of a change from their usual game plan. So you mentioned Dias there. Talk about him. I mean, he's been a target for City for nearly like 2 years. I remember his name kind of cropping up on my radar about late 2018. He's the record signing. It's another 60-odd million pounds that they've spent. You know, not in today's market, not like a huge amount of money, but although 60 million pounds add up, a lot of them's gone on the defence in the past few years. And, you know, they feel now that they've got their replacement for Vincent Kompany. They feel they've got a good deal. He's a charismatic player. He's a leader. He sets standards. There's a certain intensity to him. He's only 23 years old. So he's got that ability, that room to develop. But, I still think there's, like I said before, it's not necessarily about personnel this. It's about Guardiola's system and how it's so finely tuned. And we've spoke before about how, you know, total football almost corrupts totally. You know, one single thing goes wrong in it, the whole thing comes crashing down. And whether Dias is the man to fix that, I'm really not certain. I think I tweeted out my match report at the end of the game, like, oh, don't worry, it's nothing another £64 million on a defender won't fix. Because that seems like it's been the situation for about the last 18 months at Manchester City. And you do wonder just how Guardiola fixes it if it's not in the transfer market.
Jack, just to bring you in here, what do you make of, I suppose, the Dias signing, not necessarily the individual himself, but of how it reflects on Manchester City and, I suppose, Guardiola to an extent and how he's looking to close the gap on Liverpool. Liverpool already 6 points ahead, having played a game more, it should be said. But with Dias, Nathan Ake and Ferran Torres, that's £122 million combined this summer. Torres, I think it's kind of safe to say that he's going to start on the periphery and maybe, you know, end the season on the periphery, being as young as he is, only 20. But where do you see, you know, this iteration of City in regards to what they're trying to, or how they're trying to catch up on Liverpool?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting one for City because obviously they were so far off the pace last season, but it was a freak incident that you'd expect Liverpool to come back to the pack a little bit, but after three games, they haven't looked their best, but they've got maximum points against three pretty tricky opponents. And all of a sudden, despite City's wealth, their squad now looks pretty threadbare. I think you look at the squad or the team that Pep picked against Leicester, the bench was was a little bit vulnerable. You have the likes of Aguero and Gabriel out injured. Gundogan was out. Cancelo. Bernardo Silva hasn't really hit the heights that he's capable for maybe about a year now. So I think suddenly there is a little bit of an over-reliance on De Bruyne. I mean, Foden, it was the wild card, I think, because even though he's just come in and he was already there, but I think you expect him to go up a couple levels and contribute a lot. But yeah, I just think it's less about the personnel in terms of, you mentioned Diaz and even Ake, like wonderful talent, came through at Chelsea and it was never quite the right moment. But I think he's certainly talented enough to play for Chelsea, or was over the last couple of seasons. And now City have got a pretty fine player there. But it's the system. And I just think it's against Wolves, it looked like that double anchor of Rodri and Fernandinho. It worked pretty nicely, but then against Leicester, the consistency wasn't there and they were just exposed. So it's all about whether Guardiola can fit them all in. I think Mendy is a real issue, somebody that has pretty much everything required to be the dominant left-back in world football, except the mental lapses just seem to cost him time and time again. And it is the Achilles heel for Pep's sides, and it seems to be that moving forward. But the hope, as Krich mentions, is that Diaz is not just a wonderful talent. I think you need the personality now. It's no good just acquiring these elite talents at the back that we spent 50 and 60 million on across the board. You need that imposing figure that Kompany was, and I think the hope is that Diaz might bring that.
Well, next up for Manchester City is a trip to Elland Road against a certain Leeds United, led by a certain Marcelo Bielsa, and one of Guardiola's idols. Krich, I suppose if this was some kind of samurai film, we'd be expecting Bielsa to tear chunks out of him and then Guardiola come back later in the season and extract revenge. But where do you see, how do you see this game going? I feel like if I was going to invent a team to profit on City's vulnerabilities that they showcased against Leicester, it would be this Leeds team.
Yeah, I agree with that. But also, I think you can flip that and put it the other way and say that if there's a team that City can really expose gaps in, then it's Leeds, because it's just that kind of match of styles. And it really could just be a shooting match. You don't really know which way it would go. And I imagine it's one that people will be looking to captain the players in the Fantasy League this weekend. But yeah, I mean, you know, it's interesting for the means as well. There's obviously we like it when two managers meet up and they don't quite get on. There's a bit of a grudge match there, but this is more of a love-in, obviously, between Guardiola and Bielsa. I mean, Bielsa is like one of the biggest influences on Guardiola's coaching career. It was back in 2006, I think it was, when Guardiola was considering, at the end of his playing career, where he was considering going into management. He actually went over to Argentina to meet Bielsa with a friend of his, a guy called David Treber, who was a film director and a novelist in Spain. And they go over there and Bielsa's unemployed at the time, and he like makes them a he puts on a barbecue for them, loads of Argentinian beef, steak, stuff like that. And they have this big long, well, to begin with, I think Bielsa and his friend are just talking about film, and then about an hour in, he's like, well, you didn't come here to talk about film, did you? And they have like a good like 11, 12 hour conversation about football, and like Guardiola walks away from that in the end. Not with his football philosophy, not formed, you wouldn't say, but almost underpinned and kind of supplemented by the teachings that he's had over the past, you know, over that conversation. And there's a funny little story as well about he meets like this Argentinian student who's a blogger, who's like this Pep aficionado, and he gives him a book about Bielsa while he's on that trip. And this book's still with him today, apparently still in his office at Manchester City, that he keeps with him all the time, that he just leafs through. So, you know, this is like, it's a bit of a hipster loving, isn't it, really? But like, the meeting of ideas here between two great coaches, let's face it. And I think everybody's just intrigued to see how it'll go down. And, you know, I should say, actually, you know, that story is not mine. It's in a book, the Bielsa biography, that was written by one of my predecessors in this role, Tim Rich, who's a very good journalist. So people should check that out if they want. But, you know, there's a lot of, there's a lot of history, if you like, a lot of background to this game, a lot of subtext. And I think we're all really intrigued because it looks to me like it's going to be the game of the weekend.
Well, I mean, if that doesn't whet your appetite, nothing will. But to bring matters, I suppose, crashing back down, Manchester United still ongoing with their furlough with Jadon Sancho, currently frantically trying to salvage a deal for the Borussia Dortmund forward with less than a week to go in the transfer window. It's getting to the stage now where it looks like United are considering fullback options such as Ousmane Dembele at Barcelona. Now, 3 years on from his own move from Borussia Dortmund, and that a rather princely sum of 140 million. Critch, I know you're probably bored about talking to this, so I might actually just throw it to Jack first of all. Jack, this it feels like it's got to the stage where even if United get this over the line, questions are going to be asked on how they are going about recruiting players. They are, you know, to be taken seriously as a club who want to get back to where they belong.
Yeah, I think there's been widespread frustration among United fans throughout the summer, and I think the mistake is assuming that they've been riled by the lack of progress on Jadon Sancho. It's much deeper than that, and I think had they come in a bit more swiftly on Sancho, it would have been not just surprising that they acquired such a world class player as Sancho, but it would have been a complete change in the way that they've handled their transfer business over the last couple of years. But even beyond Sancho, you look at the makeup of their squad, and it just feels like there's something missing. Brighton certainly, they were not overawed by the occasion and the names that were in front of them. I think you look at the makeup of their team, Alzate and Lallana in midfield, not a midfield that you would expect to perhaps boss the game. And United, at times they were unable to sort of resist Brighton, and quite fortunate, obviously, in the end to pinch the points right at the death. And I think Solskjaer has been a little bit frustrated. I mean, it's clear they need players, but it's more than that now, isn't it? There needs to be a bit more of a cohesive plan in place. And I think you need a bit more time as well to bed in these changes. That much is clear. There's an element or something in common with City, I guess, in regards to the way they're purchasing players. And you see Maguire and Lindelof, I mean, both guilty of errors over the last few weeks. And the easy strategy, or the easy suggestion has been, oh, buy another centre-back, buy another midfielder. But at some point, you will look at the manager to make the most of this group of players. And I think something like that will fall on both Solskjaer and, I think, maybe we'll mention later, Lampard too, just in terms of at some point you can't acquire every single player you need. You get something and then you'll be asked to make the most of the rest of what you've got. And I think United have had that issue for several years now. I think Sancho, while he'd be a magnificent addition, I think you look at what they have and they already have game winners in that area of the pitch. They have so much speed and decisiveness. Marcus Rashford, I think, was absolutely outstanding against Brighton, the way that he can both use his natural talent and now his experience and his maturity is shining through in terms of his decision making. So, yeah, it would be a great signing, but it just feels like maybe United are missing the point here, and it's not just about buying them the glossiest players that they can.
Critch, just to bring you back in on this, what is the likelihood of that Sancho deal actually being done? And, you know, in Dembele, is it the case that United are making moves in case, or is it dead to them as well?
The likelihood of Sancho, I would say, well, talks are still ongoing. I mean, everything that you hear from the Dortmund side would be that United haven't met the 120 million euro price tag. They haven't done that by the 10th of August, and therefore there's no conversation in Jadon Sancho staying. And that may very well turn out to be the case. But, you know, my information, speaking to people the last few days, dialogue's still open between, between United and intermediaries who are acting on Dortmund's behalf. And United are still going to try and push to get their priority transfer target over the line, because they're in a position now where if they don't, unfortunately, it will be seen as a failure, because it's been such a public and such a protracted the transfer saga, that there's no real escaping that. Now, they have sought all the way through to try and make sure that there are alternatives and backups in place. And, you know, I know the Dembele stuff has picked up a little bit of traction over the last few days, but that has been something that predates, even predates Ronald Koeman coming into the Barcelona job. You know, they've always known that there's a chance that they won't get Sancho over the line and they'll need to look for somebody else. And you've heard other players like even Perisic, Inter, Douglas Costa, Gareth Bale before he went to Tottenham, all these others, and Ismail Assar's one of the more recent ones as well. All these other players are considerations. But let's make no bones about it. Sancho's always been the priority, and I think that the fact that United haven't moved on and haven't moved earlier for an alternative speaks to the fact that whether rightly or wrongly, they still feel that they can get this over the line. Now, my kind of reading the situation over the last few weeks has been that, look, Dortmund have a hard line. We want 120 million euros. United have a hard line in saying we're not going to pay that because it's unrealistic post-pandemic, during the pandemic, whatever you want to call it. And, you know, Sancho himself isn't agitating publicly for a move and is happy to kind of sit in place and wait and see what happens. And so the ball is almost in nobody's court, if you know what I mean. The ball is almost like suspended over the net in air, and it's an impasse. And maybe that's just the nature of negotiations. Maybe that's just how, when there are these hard lines involved, it does take it right up until the last minute for someone to blink. And you know, maybe United are confident that they can. There was some reports yesterday about a bid. My information was that there's been no formal bid in place yet, because if you think about it logically, if they were going to put a bid in place, Dortmund's lines would have to move. Their red lines would have to move, obviously. So, at the minute, I err more towards the idea that he won't join rather than he will, but we'll see.
Well, I get the impression that this won't be the last time we speak about it anyway. So let's keep our powder dry for now. We're going to take a break and we'll be back with you after these short moments.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction and free shipping. And that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hello, and welcome back to part two of this particular indie football podcast, and we're going to be talking about Spurs Chelsea. They had a midweek battle in the Carabao Cup that saw Spurs win on penalties after coming from behind. After Timo Werner netted his first goal for Chelsea, only to be pulled back by Eric Lamella before Mason Mount missed a crucial spot kick, the 10th after nine immaculate ones from Spurs and Chelsea. Jack, what did you make of the game? And I suppose where does this leave Frank Lampard? I suppose I'll leave him in a more general sense, considering this was probably a trophy that he was eyeing up as first bit of silverware as Chelsea boss to get him up and running.
Yeah, it was quite an interesting game. I thought that it was a classic game of two halves. I think Chelsea in the first half, while it's still quite premature in the season, it was definitely the best half of football they've played, even though it wasn't entirely immaculate. But the way they pressed, the way they hunted in packs was really impressive to see, in my opinion. Aspilicueta at right back in place of Reece James, who hasn't been bad at all. He's been pretty impressive, but Aspilicueta much more capable of moving up the pitch and joining those midfielders to sort of hound Spurs and pressurise them and move them off the ball. And Reguilón, Spurs' left wing back, was guilty at times, or the most guilty, should I say, of suffering from this. And Mourinho's system, the five at the back and that midfield three, which lacked a real sort of creative talent, it really struggled. But at half time, the experience of Mourinho, he adapted, he bypassed the press in the second half. And Chelsea just did not react. They Lampard was unable to, well, he mentioned that he spotted it after the game, but there was no sign of that in the second half, or at least there was an inability to spot it and adapt. And Spurs were much better. And I think that said, Chelsea should have finished the game. You saw Callum Hudson-Odoi, who was pretty smart, very unselfish, but then that flipped on its head when he had a really promising 2-on-1 or 2v2 situation. He shot instead of passing to Abraham. And Mason Mount, a bit of a poor game by his standards, and not just a missed penalty, but really should have slotted Werner in on another counter-attack for Chelsea that they squandered. So, yeah, really interesting to see where both teams lie after this. I think, obviously, Mourinho will be delighted because whilst it wasn't perfect, the schedule at the moment they have is gruelling. It was a different system. He didn't start Kane. Son was injured. Gareth Bale's not ready yet. They still look like they're pretty active in the market. And yet they came away with the spoils, bragging rights as such. And Eric Dier was looking better in his role at the back now. And I think Lampard, on the other hand, I think it's a concern. I think that first half was very promising, but he now needs to show a couple of facets to his game or his management and be able to change it and to adjust. I thought N'Golo Kante coming on was excellent, but not in the way that many expect him to be. He was superb in a box-to-box sense, moving the ball, manipulating it around corners, pressing high, providing angles. Really good, but that's not the player that Chelsea necessarily need. They need a foundation. And you saw, while they didn't have horrendous games, Spurs, particularly Ndombele, was excellent again and is now, perhaps after Joe Cole, maybe one of the only players Mourinho has salvaged with some tough love. They were better than Jorginho and Kovacic in the midfield, and that for me appears to be the Achilles heel, because continuity at the back and with the centre backs and Mendy coming in and just being a bit more robust and a bit more reliable than Kepa, that will help. But the midfield looks vulnerable to me, and I think the pressure is really on Lampard now after how much has been spent.
Spurs' next game is actually against Maccabi Haifa in the Europa League qualifiers on Thursday. And then they go to Old Trafford to play Manchester United on Sunday. Another return for Jose to his former club. Critch, obviously it's a brutal schedule for Spurs, but how do you assess what Mourinho has been able to do at the start of this season and how he might fare on Sunday?
I find Spurs quite a difficult team to get a handle on. I mean, any team is after three games. But them especially, because I think it's an easy thing to do, and we've been guilty of it in the past, where if they have a disappointing result, like for example in the opening weekend against Everton, and if there's a bit of tension thrown into the mix as well, as there is with Dele Alli at the moment, I think it's easy for us to just revert to kind of the Mourinho playbook and think, you know, we've seen this before, and be a little bit critical in that regard. But to be honest, I think, taking in it's nearly a year now since he came in, and I think although there's been a few poor results here and there, I think it's largely been solid but slightly unspectacular. And you'd maybe think, well, is this just Mourinho's level now? Is he a top four, a top five manager? Not much more, not much less. That being said, I mean, look, they were very good at Southampton. I think Southampton completely played into their hands. And then on Sunday, they should get the result. And I think, you know, all of us would agree that they did enough to win that game and definitely shouldn't have drawn it in the end. We've not talked about the handball thing, and I think we could just leave it because let's just avoid that argument. But I am relatively impressed, but I think the question is, you know, they are beginning to look like a Mourinho team, but is that the Chelsea of 2004, 2005? Or is that the United of 2018, 2019? Because you almost see the similarities there. There's obviously that kind of bedrock of a defence, but then very pacey, fast wingers like Robin and Duff all those years ago, in the likes of Bergwijn and Son and Gareth Bale, obviously. And Mourinho is a coach who relies so much on individuals for a lot of his attacking play. And so I think, you know, those are almost the two big variables for their season and whether it's going to be a success or not. The one is Bale. You know, what level is he at still? What can he provide after not playing regularly for quite a few years? I was looking at something before. I think he's done, like, in terms of 20 lots of 90 minutes, if you like, about, you know, roughly about 2,000 minutes, a bit less than that, 1,800, whatever. He's only done that in the league since, he's not done that since 2015. So you're talking 5 years without a good solid amount of minutes under his belt in a league season. And if you look at his some of his numbers and stats from last season, they fell off completely as well. So, you know, whereas he does come in as a big boost for Tottenham and, like, you know, this big heart back to the glory days and stuff, there is a question there over just what he's going to be able to provide. And then the other one's Kane as well. He's the other kind of variable. To what extent can he return to his level of 2 or 3 years ago? Maybe he's a bit of a different player. I think he leads the league in assists now. He's got 5, whereas, like, the next best player's got 2. So he's obviously, you know, is he adapting his game slightly? Do Tottenham lose something because of that? I think those are the two big questions for Spurs this season. But generally, although we are prone to, like, the knee-jerk stuff that I was saying before about, oh, it's all going, we've seen this episode before, this is just a Jose Mourinho. I think there are signs of improvement there, and it's a very gradual, slow process, but they are certainly getting better.
Well, we'll move on to transfers. As we mentioned earlier in the show, Monday's transfer deadline is fast approaching. And I suppose today, really, including one while we've been recording, we've had some pretty high-profile deals around English players. This morning, I'm recording on Wednesday, by the way, Ross Barkley completed a loan move from Chelsea to Aston Villa. And in the last half an hour, I think, Ademola Lookman has moved to Fulham on loan from RB Leipzig. Jack, we'll start with Ross Barkley. It's rare that a player who, I suppose, let's say he played prominently for Chelsea last year and helped them to qualify for the Champions League. It's rare for a player to make a drop to a team that finished 17th. Can you talk us through that one? I suppose particularly Ross Barkley, a player, really, because certainly from a personal point of view, I've always found him a bit of a conundrum.
Yeah, he's a fascinating player because I think he's transformed himself into something that, I mean, it's an illusion almost. What he was at Everton was that player that was a box-to-box midfielder who would get you lots of goals and would almost be a luxury player. But at Chelsea, he transformed his game. He acquired an intelligence and maturity and really became a reliable squad player. Maurizio Sarri really used him in a possession-based game and someone that could come in against top six opponents and be trusted. And that sort of overlapped into Lampard's first season at Chelsea. And the start of this season, I think he deserved more opportunities. It felt like he was going to get them. He was positive off the bench against Brighton. He obviously, I mean, he didn't play well against Barnsley. He got himself a goal. But this is a player who I think gives Lampard a bit more versatility. I think he still hasn't made up his mind whether he goes with a 1-2 shape in that midfield or just two anchors. And I think Barkley, without him certainly, I think Chelsea really lack a bit of depth there. And I think the general consensus has been that it's a loss for Chelsea. There's no doubt about it. The squad depth is thinner now. And for Villa, I think it's a wonderful signing. I think you look at the work that Villa have done now, it's so impressive. You look at Matty Cash, you look at Watkins, I think Traore, and keeping Jack Grealish. I think that's excellent. And the midfield, for me, is looking like not just relegation survivors. I think that will work right into mid-table. Douglas Luiz, I think McGinn, and now Ross Barkley. I think that adds real balance. Barkley, I think, given minutes under his belt, can shoulder the burden on Jack Grealish as well and sort of dovetail a little bit there because he has played in a front three or just in behind the striker for Chelsea. And I think that it just says a lot that it's an ambitious move for Dean Smith and Villa. And I think at 26, while it didn't make... I think it says a lot because for Chelsea, it didn't make too much sense, especially given the loan fee is not going to be enough to sort of trade out somebody and bring in the likes of Declan Rice. this must be something that's been driven from Barkley's side, and he's looking at maybe cementing his place in the England squad, playing it next summer's Euros. So good for him. I think this is a really interesting move, and to see him now really with what will likely be week in, week out starts, I think you might see the best football of his career.
Yeah, well said. As I said, I found him a bit of a conundrum, but he might actually find his feet a bit more with, potentially less pressure, but also I suppose more around him to work with in terms of being able to, I suppose, do a few different roles rather than have to do one sitting role a bit more diligently. Critch, Adebola Lookman's a fascinating player as well, really. I feel like he was given every chance to succeed at Everton and things didn't quite work out. What do you make of him as a player and what he might be able to do for Fulham, who, I'll be honest, when I saw them on Monday, I didn't think, yeah, they need more wingers.
No, I didn't think that either. Yeah, I feel like with Lookman, I don't know about the Everton move. I think that he was given the opportunity every now and again there, but he definitely, his time at Everton kind of coincided with a bit of a difficult period for the club. You had the turnover of managers with Coleman, then with Allardyce, and you know in between those ones, it was a bit. And I feel like with him, you know, the best that we've ever seen of him was when he had that loan spell out at RB Leipzig. And I think I'm right in saying that was under Hasenhüttl. And then he obviously went back out there permanently. But by that time, Hasenhüttl had gone. And I feel like sometimes, you know, there's a lot of young talent that just makes the wrong move here or there, just trips up because of things that are out of the control. And then suddenly they find themselves not developing in the way that they should and on the time frame that they would have expected. And I think that's probably been, you could say that's been the case with Lookman since he went to Leipzig permanently. I think there's definitely a player there. But if I was him, I would be slightly worried that by going to Fulham in the state that they're in at the moment with the prospects that they've got ahead of them this season, that he may have just kind of just turned up in the wrong place at the wrong time again, perhaps. That would be the concern for him. So, yeah, I don't know. I feel like there's a lot of young players that sometimes just take the wrong turn. And I hope that it is a positive move for him. But you can't help but feel that there's going to be a lot of churn and a lot of uncertainty at Fulham this season. That might not be the best place for a player of his talents and ability and his age, because you know he's not especially young anymore. He needs to be getting regular minutes and developing, basically. You wonder whether that's the best place for him.
Well, we're coming to the end of our pod, and I suppose this is a time I've got to ask both of you for a hero and a villain. Critch, you're on hero. Do you have anyone in mind? Bear in mind that your villain last week was COVID-19. So, okay. Yeah, who's your hero?
Who's my hero? Maybe he's the answer to COVID-19. I'm going to go for Brendan Rodgers. I'm going to go for Brendan Rodgers because obviously he got the result of the weekend. But I enjoyed the way that he said afterwards how, you know, what he did was, this was kind of like pragmatic and functional Brendan Rodgers, you know, winning the battle against his inner Brendan and his better judgment, if you like, and not being the big, expansive, progressive coach that he has been in the past, but actually sitting deep, you know, parking the bus, if you like, and encountering. And, you know, it does take a degree of bravery and a degree of realism to do that sometimes. And arguably not enough managers do it. I don't know. But it worked for him and he got a result. So, yeah, I'll... Slightly less macabre this week, but I'll go for Brendan Rodgers rather than COVID-19.
Fair dues. Self-aware Brendan Rodgers as the hero. Jack, who's your villain?
Tricky one. Perhaps not as impactful as COVID-19, but who could say? Neil Malpay, for me, is the villain with his moment of madness to handle.
So dumb. That was so dumb, wasn't it?
Ridiculous. And probably his goals will define Brighton's season, but he certainly cost his side one famous point, and it could have been worth way more than 1 point because it was a breakout performance from Potter's side. They really imposed themselves on United, and to come away with nothing thanks to his stupidity was a real gut check. And yeah, he's my villain of the week, but a honourable mention for Danny Ings going back to Burnley and deciding that outcome for Saints. One that got away, I guess. But for me, Neil Maupay, villain of the week.
Fair dues. Great. Well, that's all we've got time for, I'm afraid. Thanks again to Mark and Jack for joining me. And thank you all as well for listening. If you are a new listener, please subscribe to this show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever you get your podcast from. And also leave us a rating as well, because that'll help people find us. Be sure to also follow Indie Sport and Indie Football on social media to keep up to date with everything that's going on. And we'll see you all next week. Goodbye.